Hello there. Today is Tuesday, July 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the UN watchdog confirms Iran has breached its nuclear deal agreement. Journalists say President Trump's jokes with Vladimir Putin about the press are no laughing matter. Also ahead, a big festival celebrating African-American women marks its 25th anniversary. It's all on today's International Edition. Iran announced Monday that it had exceeded the limit on its stockpile of low-enriched uranium it agreed to in the 2015 international accord that restrained its nuclear weapons development. Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif made the announcement on the semi-official news agency ISNA. VOA's Latika Hoke has the story.
Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif said Monday that Iran is acting according to its rights stipulated in the international agreement, which the Trump administration abandoned last year.
Iran has crossed 300 kilogram limit, as we've announced earlier. We said very clearly what we were going to do and are acting on it. We consider it our right based on the international agreement.
Iranian leaders are trying to gain leverage in their struggle to get relief from U.S.-imposed sanctions, said analyst Catherine Bauer.
They're not necessarily looking for a way to export their low-enriched uranium. They're looking for a way to get some economic relief, to gain some leverage. And hopefully that means they want to re-enter negotiations, but I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon.
The Trump administration has imposed tough economic sanctions on Iran to cripple its economy and force it to agree to renegotiating the nuclear deal that U.S. President Donald Trump considers inadequate. Iran is not likely to do that in the near future, says analyst Alan Makovsky.
I think that Iran has the wherewithal that they will not do that, certainly not under the Trump administration. I think they're hoping Trump will be defeated in 2020 and perhaps they'll get a fresh start.
Makovsky says it would be a major loss of face for Tehran to return to negotiations. Iran is more likely to engage in provocations, such as arming Houthi rebels in Yemen and staging attacks through third parties.
Using proxies is one of Iran's most preferred ways of responding to sanctions and to other policies of the United States, which it objects, because use of proxies gives them a certain plausible deniability.
Both Iran and the United States have said they do not want war. U.S. President Donald Trump has been pressured by those who want a military response to Iran's provocations and those who urge de-escalation. He says he is in no hurry to respond.
Sanctions are on, and I'm in no rush. I'm in no rush with Iran. I'm never in a rush. If you're in a rush, you get yourself in trouble.
Analysts say it is not clear if and when the sanctions will produce the desired effect. Makovsky pointed out that Iraq under Saddam Hussein had been able to hold out. North Korea has carried out 6 nuclear arms tests despite years of international sanctions. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
Protesters returned to the streets of Hong Kong early Monday to mark the 22nd anniversary of the city's reunification with China. Thousands encircled the city's government complex in the afternoon as a small group attempted to break into the legislature while police waited inside and fired pepper spray through the gates. Similar protests were also launched in cities such as New York City, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Toronto, London, Paris, and more. VOA Asia's Michelle Anna Liu spoke with one of the organizers of the New York demonstration who identified himself as Ken. He said what is happening in Hong Kong deserves worldwide attention.
Right now, the majority of the Hong Kong people is in a position of the extradition law for different reasons. And one of them that, as Americans, we really should care about is this law is applicable to not just Hong Kong citizens, but also applicable to basically anyone who steps foot in Hong Kong, as long as the Chinese government believe that some person has violated the mainland Chinese law. Doesn't matter where the so-called crime is committed, innocent have to be proven guilty, as long as whatever the law that the communist Chinese government accuses some person to be committing, as long as the maximum penalty is 7 years or more, then as long as the person lands foot in Hong Kong can be extradited to China for trial. And we also have to understand that we are talking about a country that has a really bad record in human rights, and they do have tortures of prisoners, and we even have gulag for people, you know, labor camps for prisoners as well. So this is definitely a danger to world's human rights and the freedom in general. So I think this is also something that is a global value we all have to protect, not just for the Hong Kong people, but this is this is basically a black and white issue where, you know, if you are against freedom and human rights, I think this is something, you know, everyone in the world should be fighting against.
How long do you think the protests will continue to last? Do you think it will take another couple of weeks, maybe a month? Because I think I remember the Umbrella Revolution took like a few months. So,
right, Umbrella Movement, I think that's the proper term, lasted 79 days. I think this time is very different. That one was about universal suffrage for voting of the Hong Kong chief executive. But this time, we have different type of demand, and we are trying to basically protest the freedom that we don't want to be stripped off. We're not even asking for new rights or new freedom. We just want to protect what we have. And right now, I think the timeline is not governed by the protesters. It's basically governed by the Hong Kong government in terms of whether they can meet the demands of the Hong Kong people. And then we want to have a independent bureau that investigates the excessive use of force by the Hong Kong policemen. And we also wanted the protesters can be excused from the persecution by the government. This can definitely last a long time if Hong Kong government is unwilling to step down. And this is basically the last defense that Hong Kong people will have. They understand how great the situation is. So they definitely don't want to lose on this one.
The extradition debate has seen the government unwittingly reignite Hong Kong's protest movement and calls for the direct election of its leader. Many protesters have pointed to the government's failure to respond to popular demands as a sign that the city's political system is broken. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and U.S. President Donald Trump agreed at their meeting on Sunday to push forward dialogue for making a new breakthrough in the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Trump became the first U.S. sitting president to set foot in North Korea Sunday when he met with Kim in the demilitarized zone between the two Koreas and agreed to resume stalled nuclear talks. The meeting, initiated by a tweet by Trump, said that Kim said, or a tweet by Kim that Kim said took him by surprise. It displayed the rapport between the two, but analysts said they're no closer to narrowing the gap between their positions since they walked away from the summit in February in Vietnam. John Blaxland, professor of international security and intelligence studies at the Australian National University, joins us. Professor, what do you make of the president's strategy of tweeting to get Kim Jong-un's attention?
Diplomacy by Twitter storm. And it's really setting a new precedent, a new bar, if you like, or maybe a new low, for the way international diplomacy marginalizes the professional diplomats and career foreign service officers, or an approach that has so far patently fallen short of even President Trump's own expectations. The prospect of complete, verifiable, irreversible denuclearization is not talked about anymore, realistically. It's off the table, and it is becoming disconcerting for other international observers, good friends of the United States, countries like Australia. that are very much eager for the United States to be successful in its aspirations and in its endeavours, looking on, despairing at the approach being taken and the consequences of what's been happening. And here, there are consequences not just on the North Korean issue in the Korean Peninsula, but on the other, watching Donald Trump's game plan, and they are weighing up the implications for the way they respond to U.S. pressures over the so-called joint comprehensive plan of action.
Between Trump and Kim, there seems to be a very strong mutual admiration, which is unusual, to say the least. And it seems like Kim sort of knows how to get Trump to warm up. Do you think that this is sending a message to Iran that all we need to do is write the U.S. complimentary love letters?
I'm not sure if that's quite the case. I think what we have here is two fairly narcissistic individuals who are lapping up the international attention. They are dominating the global media airwaves. They are not achieving very much except doing that. And there is, I think, a real concern that the implications from this being read in Tehran are that the Iranians have to pretty much double down on the approach they've taken, which is play hardball, knowing that Trump really doesn't have it in him to follow through on the rhetoric of war, of escalating confrontation. President Trump has used extreme language in the past when talking mm-hmm. about North Korea,
mm-hmm.
And then he's gone and used extreme language in the opposite direction. So we've seen a game plan unfold, I think, in Iran, over Iran, that has strong parallels with and has unfolded on the Korean Peninsula over the last 2 years. And the Iranians are watching closely, and the Iranians will be drawing deductions from this about the way they need to be pressing on with their approach to undermine the resolve of US coalition partners, particularly in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states, and of course, member states of the European Union.
How likely is it, do you think, that these warming relations with North Korea will actually lead to that country taking any substantive actions to appease the U.S. and the world community? And do you think that this tactic by Trump is sort of creating a situation where we have nothing now, we have no bargaining chips left because he's already basically giving them what they wanted the most, which was relations with the United States president?
Well, look, I think Kim Jong-un has played his hand very, very carefully. And of course, his engagement with President Xi from China has strengthened his hand and made President Trump's endeavors look less consequential than they would otherwise be. Kim Jong-un now knows that he's got a strong hand and that President Trump really doesn't have many options to better the hand that he has been presented with. And that means that we face a situation where President Xi is effectively, by going to North Korea and making a very public endorsement of the North Korean regime mm-hmm. by his very presence, has sent a signal that the United States really can't win on this. The United States is not in a position to achieve its objectives of denuclearizing North Korea or of getting significant concessions that would see the nuclear program wound back inside North Korea. That just looks extremely unlikely at this stage.
Do we still have leverage because of sanctions?
There is still leverage because of sanctions, but the North Koreans have a remarkable pain threshold, able to endure and withstand incredible pressures, sanctions that have been longstanding with a repressive and controlling regime that will see many of the central elite protected from the sanctions. Pain will be felt by the average North Korean, not necessarily by the power holders inside North Korea.
All right, that's John Blaxland, Professor of International Security and Intelligence Studies at the Australian National University. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The U.S. Embassy in Russia is worried about the condition of a jailed American. More deaths reported in Sudan protests. Libya tensions escalate after Tripoli takes a key strategic town. And when Americans go on vacation, puppy checks into a luxury resort. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. At last week's G20 Economic Summit, President Donald Trump and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin sat down to talk on the sidelines of the G20 Economic Summit and joked about journalists in front of a a packed room of journalists. Trump said, quote, get rid of them. Fake news is a great term, isn't it? You don't have this problem in Russia, but we do. Putin answered in English, we also have. It's the same. Trump routinely describes journalists as the enemy of the people, an expression first common in world literature and a century ago popularized by Russian autocrat Vladimir Lenin. Joining us to talk more about the safety implications of these kinds of statements is Courtney Radch, advocacy director with the Committee to Protect Journalists. Thank you for being with us. What is your reaction to the latest interaction with Vladimir Putin on the media?
I mean, it's just shocking for the president of the United States to joke with the president of Russia about fake news and to basically denigrate journalists. With a president of a country that is among the worst abusers of press freedom and journalists in the world, there are journalists behind bars in Russia. There are many journalists who have been killed in Russia. So of the 58 journalists that have been killed in Russia since we began keeping records in 1992, 38 of them were targeted for murder, and nearly all of them have been murdered with impunity. There's no effort to investigate the murder of journalists. Meanwhile, you have the president of the United States joking around about something that is having a real impact on journalists in Russia, where, you know, we report on a, you know, daily and weekly basis about the threats and dangers that journalists in Russia are facing.
Even beyond Russia, the president has basically called news here in the United States that he doesn't like fake news. He even went so far as to say something pertaining to a New York Times article that it was a virtual act of treason. That's a crime that could lead to a death penalty.
Yeah, we've really seen the president of the United States ratchet up his rhetoric against the press, and it seems to be part of a concerted strategy to undermine the press as well as to denigrate and pillory the press at a time when they are already under threat, and as an effort to inculcate himself against criticism or any sort of independent or critical reporting. And we actually did an analysis of his Twitter feed, and we found that the rhetoric that he has used since he became a candidate has kind of gone from the pillorying and singling out of individual journalists and media to the fake news trope and the constant battering of media and journalists as fake news, which then, of course, ricocheted and took off around the world. And then more recently transitioned to including the use of the term enemy of the people, which harkens back to Stalinist and Maoist times. And at least 11% of his tweets during the period that we analyzed were anti-press or some targeting journalists. And this is really disturbing. And I think that when you start, you know, bandying about things like enemy of the people and treason, sends a very dangerous signal, not only to journalists in the United States, but also to journalists around the world. And the other thing that it's important to point out is that when he made that comment to President Putin, it was the anniversary of the deadliest attack on American journalists in history since we began keeping records, the anniversary of the Capitol Gazette shooting. And that is no joking matter. We have heard from journalists around the country that they have had to up their security, that they have had to invest in security systems, panic buttons, glass windows, security guards, trauma training for their staff, all of these sort of things, which come at a time when it's a very economically challenging time for the media. And so now they're having to put more money towards security. And you add this to the fact that in the United States, according to the U.S. Press Freedom Tracker, where we track these issues in the United States systematically, even kind of public gatherings, demonstrations, political rallies are the most dangerous times for journalists. So you have a constellation of factors that are creating really dangerous conditions for journalists right now. We've already seen two political rallies where journalists were attacked. Saw the Antifa protesters attack a journalist. It sends a signal, regardless of what political side you're on, that it's somehow okay to attack and denigrate the press, which is actually a fundamental pillar of democracy.
The president also, while on the G20, was praising Saudi Prince Mohammed bin Salman as a friend, singing his praises, and doesn't seem to be concerned about the killing of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul last October. Would you say that this is another detriment to journalists, that if something were to happen, that the U.S. would not stand up for them or, you know, protect them or seek justice if something did happen?
We have seen the president really fail in his duty to be a leader of the free world and to stand up for basic human rights like press freedom and the failure to condemn the killing of Khashoggi and therefore hold those responsible to account, including Mohammed bin Salman and top-level officials that his own intelligence services identified with a medium to high degree of certainty were responsible for the killing, and a finding that was reiterated by the UN Independent Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Killings. The fact that President Trump continues to be buddy-buddy with Crown Prince bin Salman, you've got 16 journalists in jail in Saudi Arabia. You've got killings of journalists in Saudi Arabia that have not been solved. It is a nightmare for journalists there. It's very challenging to work. And it sends a very, very chilling message to journalists and to the broader press freedom advocacy community, to those of us who are trying to, you know, promote these ideals around the world.
All right. Courtney Raj, she's the advocacy director with the Committee for or to Protect Journalists. Thanks so much for being with us. The International Labor Organization is launching a report dealing with the impact of heat stress stemming from climate change on labor productivity. It expects this could lead to global economic losses of $2.4 billion by 2030. Southern Asia and Western Africa are predicted to be most affected in terms of job losses. Lisa Schlein has more.
The ILO reports rising temperatures and increasing heat stress at work will lead to the loss of 80 million full-time jobs and to global economic losses of $2.4 trillion in 2030. Authors of the study call their estimates conservative, as projections are based on a global temperature rise of 1.5 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. Climate scientists predict temperatures could rise by as much as 3 degrees Celsius. The report says people who work outdoors, mainly in the agricultural and construction sectors, will be most affected by rising temperatures. It says agriculture will account for 60% of global working hours lost due to heat stress, followed by the construction sector with an estimated loss of 19%. The chief of the ILO's research department and a main author of the report, Catherine Saget, says Southern Asia and Western Africa are the most seriously affected regions. She says seven of the hardest hit areas are described as least developed countries in Africa.
Heat stress is concentrated in countries, in regions with existing decent work deficits, a large share of informal employment, extended working poverty, and limited social security coverage. In Africa, for example, 75% of the population has no legal health protection.
Saget says 2.3% of working hours will be lost in Africa in 2030 due to heat stress, which is higher than the global average of 2.2%. The report says workers in wealthy countries also will be affected by excessive heat, but to a much lesser extent than those in poor countries. This, it notes, will widen the inequality gap between low and high-income countries and result in worsening working conditions for the most vulnerable. The ILO urges governments to enact policies to address heat stress risks and protect workers. These include the creation of better working conditions and improving early warning systems for heat events. It also calls for enhancing occupational safety and health to help people tackle heat-related hazards. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Voices. We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Heidi Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. In spite of public pressure for priests to reveal information they learn in the confessional, the Vatican's highest court has issued a document approved by Pope Francis that explains why priests should not disclose such details. The document says that although not always understood by the modern world, the seal of the confessional is inviolable, indispensable, and necessary for the penitent's freedom of conscience. Sabina Castelfranco has more for VOA.
A 6-page document signed by the head of the Vatican's Apostolic Penitentiary, a tribunal which deals with absolution and confessional matters, and approved by Pope Francis in June, reaffirms the inviolability of the confidentiality of confession. The clergy is obliged to maintain the secrecy of the confessional because it effectively transcends any and all human laws. A priest, the document says, is a conduit for the penitent to speak directly to God. The document further states every political or legislative initiative aimed at forcing the inviolability of the sacramental seal would constitute an unacceptable offense against the freedom of the Church, which doesn't receive its very legitimization from any single country but from God. This new document clarifies the position for priests who may hear something that they may feel needs to be reported to the police. The Vatican effectively exonerates them from repeating to anyone what they heard during confession. Since the sexual abuse scandals erupted, 7 U.S. states have passed laws requiring priests to report confessions of sexual abuse of minors, with more likely to do so. The statement issued by Cardinal Mauro Piacenza and published Monday, even though it only affirms existing church teachings, sets church and state firmly on a collision course. In Australia as well, 2 of the country's 8 states have introduced laws making it a crime for priests to withhold information about abuse heard in confession. Cardinal Piacenza, however, did clarify in a written comment on the document that there has been no change to Pope Francis's resolve to combat clerical abuse and cover-up. He wrote, "It's opportune to make clear that the text of the statement cannot and doesn't want to be in any way a justification or a form of tolerance of the abhorrent cases of abuse perpetrated by members of the clergy." He added that no compromise is acceptable in promoting the protection of minors and of vulnerable persons, and in preventing and combating every form of abuse in the spirit of that which has been constantly reiterated. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
The Essence Festival, which draws thousands of to New Orleans during the 4th of July week, is celebrating 25 years of bringing African-American women of all ages together for thought-provoking conversation and performances from top musical artists. The festival, initially launched to mark the anniversary of the Black-owned Essence magazine, has now grown into an annual celebration that highlights the excellence in business, fashion, entertainment, and music. Grammy Award-winning songstress Mary J. Blige is one of many African-American musical artists performing. Blige takes the main stage on Saturday at the Superdome. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
This is VOA News.